This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to One to One, a series where I, Bertie, a longtime writer for Eurogamer, track down wonderful people from around the world of games for a proper chat. Remember, supporters of Eurogamer, get these episodes before everyone else. Check the description below for more information. Today on One to One, two giants of British gaming. They are the founders of Games Workshop, the creators of Fighting Fantasy, before they each went on to move into video games, where they would individually help establish series like Tomb Raider and Hitman, create iconic British studio Lionhead, and be tasked by the government to help lead a report into the entire industry and how it could be changed into a world-leading force. They'd go on to win BAFTAs, and one of them even a knighthood. Games simply wouldn't be the same without them. They are Ian Livingston and Steve Jackson. Welcome both of you to the show.
Good morning and welcome. Thank you very much.
I say welcome to Steve. He's having some technical issues at the moment, so hopefully he pops up at some point. But he's not there just at the moment, although you may be able to see him. So it's a big year for you both because we're celebrating 40 years since the first Fighting Fantasy book came out. It's also 40 years since I was first released, so to speak, so it's a double celebration. How do you feel about it being 40 years ago since you first published a Fighting Fantasy book? There's so much history there, so many lives touched. There's even a Fighting Fantasy Fest, I see, in its fourth year.
Well, we're delighted the Warlock of Fight Up Mountain Fighting Fantasy has survived the test of time, rather like a James Bond movie. We have move from one generation to the next, and that's very gratifying and heartening. And you know, it's been always been a passion project for Steve and I, and it'll go on forever. And I don't think we'll ever stop writing Fighting Fantasy game books because they're so close to our heart. And also the fact they were instrumental in getting a lot of people into the industry of not just tabletop games but also video games is also a great, you know, we get a great feeling in meeting people who read them in the 1980s and have fully grown adults, and they kind of revert to child when they talk about Fighting Fantasy, about the impact it had on their imaginations and inspire them to be who they are today. It's an amazing, gratifying feeling. And, you know, we're humbled in many ways by the effect it's had on the industry. And of course, we're particularly proud. They've sold nearly 20 million copies now during that long period.
So to mark the occasion, you've both written completely new Fighting Fantasy books that are coming out in early September. I think you said 1st of September?
Correct, yeah.
The books are Shadow of the Giants, that's your book, Ian, yeah. I think, and Secrets of Salamonis. I keep saying salmon, my eyes just see salmon for some reason. Sorry, Steve, and that's Steve's book. When did the idea come about to write two new books, and whose idea was it?
Well, it was the 40th anniversary, and we were always going to do something. We did discuss writing a return to Firetop Mountain in some way, because that's where it all started, where Steve and I co-wrote The Warlock of Firetop Mountain, and I did the first half up to the river, and he did the second half, and so we did our individual books. So we thought, wouldn't it be great to cooperate again on a return to Firetop Mountain? But we realized how impossible that is. writing an interactive book with a game system attached to it, handing over multiple story points to another author is quite a cruel thing to have to do to somebody. So we thought, let's write two separate ones. And Scholastic, our publishers, were very, very happy to do that. So, you know, I began Shadows of Giants and Steve began writing Secrets of Salamanis.
How does it feel to be writing them again? Was it hard to actually do it? Were you a bit rusty, or does it come back like riding a bike?
Well, I haven't really stopped. I've just slowed up a bit. I wrote one a couple of years ago, Assassin of Valencia, and before that, Port of Peril. But the technique hasn't changed. For me, it's a case of having 400 numbers, and then you start on a writing a keeping a record of the adventure on a flow chart. So you allocate number one as a starting point, and that splits to 77 and 300 for sake of argument, and you make notes and annotations against each point. And so you're keeping a record of this multiple choice adventure going forward, and bring them back in pinch points to one point, so a reader can have essential information which shouldn't be missed. But the technique hasn't changed. I used to write with a fountain pen, but that's changed. Obviously, I write into a strange little computer, but making the physical map and having the physical numbers hasn't changed at all.
So you still make a physical map?
Yep, and it's still no use of software. We don't get anywhere near flying or anything. I'll be able to show you at the end of the interview the map if you're so interested.
It's like we have a Foley department making map rustling noises there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I was looking for it, but then realized this is all.
So that's the process, and has that always been the process since day one? Were you like, this is how we're going to do this? 400 yeah. points.
Well, the 400 points was almost by chance. I think when the first book was written, it was like 399. So Steve put a false reference point in there just to make it up to nice and neat of 400. So, and for me, ever since then, they've always been 400 references. And that's why it's always turned to 400, has become a catchphrase. And yeah.
It must have been quite messy back in the day? Because now, of course, you keep everything nice and neat on a computer. But if you're writing by pen and you're putting everything on paper back... Yeah. Did it start to get a bit cumbersome as things were getting...
Well, you don't know anything different. It was before the computers were available in any meaningful way. And so I just hand-wrote them with a fountain pen. My girlfriend at the time used to type up into a manuscript. And then we deliver this big lump of paper to publisher's Penguin. But the way the whole came about was fortuitous in itself. As you said, we'd been running games workshops since 1975. We were the distributors of Dungeons & Dragons. We were obsessed with playing D&D. And that whole exploring dungeons, killing monsters, finding treasure, role-playing, having characters, and having a game system to resolve battles or events was deep in our psyche for many years. And we used to run these events called Games Day.
Yeah.
One of which was Geraldine Cook, who was the Penguin editor. And she was fascinated by what was happening at Games Day, literally thousands of people playing D&D in a very kind of frantic way. And she said, would we be interested in writing a book about this phenomenon called Dungeons and Dragons? And we said, well, rather than writing a book about the phenomenon, why can't we write a book that allows you to experience what it is to role play? Idea. So we set ourselves a task we hadn't even thought about. And then we started to work on a format, and we gave her a synopsis, which was entitled The Magic Quest. It had a kind of branching narrative and with suggestions of a game system attached to that. And she took it away, Geraldine, to her editor at Penguin Books, and not to the senior editors, who apparently laughed so hard their head hit the table.
That really?
The idea of an interactive book was preposterous and no one would ever buy them. But she, to her great credit, carried on batting for our concept, and ultimately she managed to convince the Puffin editor that this would be a good thing for children rather than an adult book. So 3 years later, Warlock of Fight Mountain came out, but it was really down to Geraldine's determination. And then Steve had the door. Desk of, because we had different writing styles. My writing up to the river was a different style to his.
So yeah, Steve, you divided it in half.
Steve very graciously volunteered to rewrite the whole thing to one standardized format. And then they published it in August 82. It didn't do very well. We were promoting it through White Magazine ourselves. But then it spread into a couple of playgrounds at schools. And of course, that was the virality of the day. Obviously there's no internet or mobile phones, so it was just the very powerful word of mouth. So pockets of of fans have started appearing all over the country via playgrounds and schools, and then it became a national phenomenon. But they, Penguin, still didn't really get their heads around it. They reprinted like a dozen times in the first couple of months until Geraldine came on the phone and said, "Great news, we want two more." So then Steve wrote Citadel of Chaos as book two, and I wrote The Forest of Doom as book three, and they went on to have phenomenal success.
Because I read that Penguin or Puffin were so sort of eager for more eventually that you couldn't collaborate on them because it was more productive to do one each. But judging by what you were saying earlier, it actually just made more sense to write them separately. Oh, Steve's holding up a sign. Keep recording, switch off. Ah, I see. That's up to you. It's like a sign. It's like Steve is a hostage holding up a sign for us to read in the background. It's like a mystery in and of itself. Go east.
Start
go
giving east. Branching narrative choices. You're going to hold up one, two hands.
We'll go east. I don't know. Up to you. Up to you, Steve. So
we're in the reason why we had guest authors, several years later, is that we couldn't actually keep up with the demand because Puffin suddenly wanted one every 2 months, and we were running Games Workshop during the day, coming home to our respective homes and having to write Final Fantasy game books from like 8 p.m. to like 2 a.m. in the morning, and that was having quite an impact on our sanity, which we managed to do for a couple of years until we finally decided to get some help. So some of the guest authors came on as what we call the Steve Jackson and Ian Livingstone Presents books as the series continued to grow till Puffin finally called it a day after 59 books in 1995. At the same time, Workshop was growing from its very humble beginnings into a what was like now becoming a large games industry, a large games company.
Yeah, so let's talk about Games Workshop quickly, because I was reading back again about your okay, so tell me a bit about Games Workshop, because this is where it kind of all begins for you. And from what I've read, you know, at school, I don't know how I got into reading about your schooling, but apparently, Ian, you got like one A-level and it was in geography. But then somehow you're in a flat together living with Steve and another person, John Peake, someone like that. And it's from there you start Games Workshop. But there's quite a lot of time between you kind of leaving school and starting Games Workshop. So is this an idea that you'd always have? How did you and Steve meet, in fact?
We met at Alton Grammar School.
Okay.
And
and you're a couple of years older, are you?
About a year and a half older. Okay. Let's not say 2 years, eh? And we both shared a love of Lambretta scooters, as did our third friend, John Peake. But we also admitted that we liked playing board games as well. So we had these common interests and we used to play board games as well. And Steve, John and I became great friends at school. They were both, obviously smart enough to go to university, unlike me. So they went off and I went to college in Stockport to do an HND in business studies. But gradually we all moved down to London after that education parts of our lives. And John was first and I went to share a flat with him. Then Steve joined us. But we were sharing with two other people. So we were invading their space. John, Steve and I found a new flat in Bolingbroke Road in Shepherd's Bush. And we had pretty boring jobs, badly paid. So again, we stayed in quite a lot playing board games and thought, wouldn't it be a great idea to somehow turn our hobby and passion of playing games into some sort of enterprise without understanding what that meant. So we published a small newsletter and reached out to everybody we knew in games, sent them a free newsletter.
Is this the Owl and Weasel?
It was a newsletter before the Owl and Weasel. It became Owl and Weasel. And John was also a craftsman. He was a civil engineer by profession. He was also a craftsman, and he was making Wari boards and Go boards and backgammon boards, and we sell them to some game shops and even to Harrods and do the administration. Wow. He was also writing for Games and Puzzles magazine at the time. And then we thought, well, let's turn it into a proper newsletter. So, and that was Owl and Weasel.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
We've printed 50 copies, and one of those copies found its way, don't know how, onto the desk of Gary Gygax in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He wrote to us, said, "Love your magazine. Here's a new game I invented. What do you think?" It was done.
Wow.
We played it. Steve and I became obsessed. John didn't like it at all. But we all agreed to buy as many copies as we could. And we ordered 6 copies. That's all the money we had in the world. And on the back of that order, Gygax gave us an exclusive 3-year distribution agreement for the whole of Europe.
Wow.
Because he was also operating out of a flat in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. He only, they only printed 1,000 copies of D&D. So we started selling it through Alan Weasel. People thought it was an act. We called the company Games Workshop because John's bedroom was like a workshop. And we used to see people milling around on the street sometimes. And we were on the 3rd floor because they were looking for this game shop, because it's called Games Workshop. Used to open the window, looking for Games Workshop, mate, up here. So they'd come upstairs and weren't too disappointed. They went into a rather disgusting looking living room to mooch around and pull out a copy of D&D, which they happily went away with. And we didn't have a phone in the flat, obviously no mobile phones. And our landlord, we used to share a public payphone on the ground floor, and the phone would always ring. It'd be a telephone sales for D&D, and run down the stairs, always too late. He'd be there first and hang up on people because he couldn't be bothered. And we eventually decided, let's try and do this properly. So we all had full-time jobs, and Steve and I decided we were going to go full-time. John decided not to because he had a grown-up job being a civil engineer, and he didn't want to join us on that adventure. So Steve and I went to the States in 1976 to go to Con 9, which was the games convention run by TSR. There we met Gary Gygax and all the fledgling games companies. We also had a big journey around the States, like Jack, trying to be like Jack Kerouac on the road. And stuff.
I've got that book just up here.
But... yeah, and we'd given up our flat. We had no office, nowhere to live. Ordered loads of games, sent them back to my girlfriend's apartment, and came back to the UK. And realized we had a bit of a problem on our hands. So we go to the bank manager, thought that would sort out. We'll get a loan, then we'll get we'll get some offices and get a flat. And so you go into the bank manager and say, "Hey, we've got this great game. It's a role-playing game with your hero, a wizard, and you kill monsters and find treasure." And he looks at you rather like a dog watching television, kind of completely freaked out by what we're saying, and asked us to leave. But you could understand why, because we were hardly investor ready. We just thought our enthusiasm for D&D would it immediately write out a check. So the reality was that we had just about enough money to rent a small office at the back of an estate agent, which we called the bread bin. It was tiny. We were obliged to live in Steve's van for 3 months.
Wow. How big is this van, are we talking?
It's a transit. Luxury. So we also joined a squash club nearby so we could get up in the morning, have a shave and a shower. And then into the office till about midnight, doing our mail orders, and then back into the stinky old van in October and listen to the, we called it living the dream, of course, because we were passionate about what we were doing and we didn't really see it as hardship. And this continued for a few months until we finally could afford a really awful flat on Uxbridge Road in Shepherd's Bush. And then ultimately, we were too big for the state agent to handle anymore. So we said, well, find us a premises we can operate out of. And that's how the first Games Workshop shop appeared in 1978.
And that was in Hammersmith?
Yeah, in Downing Road in Hammersmith. And we moved our operations there. So we had a retail premises on the first floor, and Steve and I were running production and publications on the floor above.
That must have actually felt like you had made it at the time. It must have been quite a moment.
Yeah. Well, it was just the day on the 1st of April on 78 when we saw the queue waiting there for the shop to open. Was amazing feeling, because we thought, what if no one turns up? I mean, we'd advertised it in White Dwarf magazine, and White Dwarf came around because we decided Alan Weasel had its day, because it was just an instant print fanzine. So we decided to up our game, excuse the pun, and and went for a full color glossy, which was a big risk because it was a big investment required to do that.
Wow. So there's a couple of years running the store before fighting fantasy becomes a thing. And you're talking to this person about the book and, you know, she takes a chance on you writing one. And you said the idea just came out at the time, you know, it just almost came out of thin air in a sense. Was it difficult?
Well, not really thin air. We've been, you know, we're D&D obsessives and we wanted, if we were going to do a book, it had to be a lot more accessible and have less commitment required for a casual reader. So we had a branching narrative with a very stripped down game system attached to give people a sense of battling.
Ah, and Steve, I think we can hear you. Sorry to interrupt you.
Whoa.
Hello.
What? Steve.
Welcome Hello. To the call.
Well, so the story's been told now.
Take over for a minute, Steve, while I get a glass of water.
Okay, so Steve, welcome to the call. It's great to have you. Great to have you.
Thank you very much. As you can tell, I'm well versed on these technical matters. Pressing the same buttons over and over again, and finally it's worked.
For those who are listening and not watching, Steve has been on the call the whole time, pushing buttons, holding up messages to us, and finally now we've got him on audio. So we're at the beginning of Fighting Fantasy and adapting the books, or adapting Dungeons & Dragons in a sense.
Basically, Fighting Fantasy was a sort of midway point between Choose Your Own Adventure type books and Dungeons and Dragons. It was somewhere in the middle, and that seems to be what was made it successful, because there were a bunch of people that were into Tolkien and Dungeons and Dragons and science fiction books, and this was the first game books that had some sort of level of depth to it.
How difficult was it coming up with a kind of game system for the books? Was it quite easy? Were you like, oh, well, we'll use a stamina thing, it's fine? Or was it actually quite hard?
We had an argument. We used to go around to Ian's place, and this time we've got to sort out, because he was doing the first half and I was doing the second half, and we hadn't sorted out what the different statistics were. So Ian wanted strength and stamina and endurance or something like that, and I wanted skills, stamina and luck, and we'd go around and have a game of snooker for it, because Ian had a snooker table. But we never got round to it in the end.
So is that how you decided arguments in those days? Because presumably, you know, you're working close together, you're living in a Ford Transit van together, you know, there must have been a few arguments. Was snooker the way when you could get to a table, I suppose?
Well, it was a good way of sorting out disputes, really, but he always used to win. So it's unfair.
So The Warlock of Firetop Mountain comes out and it's eventually a success, and you're asked to write more books. And then this launches you into, as you said, like a period of years where you're trying to run Games Workshop, you know, people shouldn't forget that you had this entire business to run as well. And then you're trying to write these books.
In evenings and weekends,
Which sounds quite draining. So let's pull back for a second and talk about what makes a good fighting fantasy book. So let's say I was going to write one, make my own rival business. I mean, I'm not going to do that. But what's an ideal starting point for a fighting fantasy book? What makes a good in?
I think I think a variety of different encounters, some monsters, some puzzles, some bits that are really tough to get through. As you probably remember, you die a lot in fighting fantasy, and but the more difficult that they were, the better the fans used to like them.
The difficulty is
because there was a playground. Sorry,
I was going to say the difficulty is a defining characteristic almost.
Yeah. I don't know whether you know which was the most difficult one that you ever came across.
Steve's games books were always more difficult than mine. I think he's delighted in torturing people more than I do. So for me, it was a question of choice and consequence, so that giving people big dilemmas of which is the right decision to make, and then giving them a very rich atmosphere as well to make them feel really immersed in the environment they were adventuring. And then, of course, my job is to lure people to their doom, try and get them to make a choice. The fun was seeing people fall on poison spikes or being toasted by some fire-breathing dragon. That's always a result.
So these deaths, did you ever worry that you were punishing people a bit hard, or was that eventually, was that something you felt you had to do almost?
Yeah, apparently there was a black market in solutions to fighting fantasy books when they came out, and they'd go around schoolyards, and enterprising players would sell photocopies of the answer, because we never gave the answers away until recently, when the hardback came out, the hardback Warlock of Firetop Mountain, a few years back.
Do you have favourite books in the series?
My own or of Ian's?
Of either.
Well, I think for Ian's, I think the one that I most admired was Death Trap Dungeon.
And why did you admire that one?
Because it was a lot of it's to do with the colour cover, I have to say. But it was a Ian McKay classic. And on mine, I think the Sorcery Adventure were four different books. Why I did four books instead of a trilogy or just two or something, I've no idea. But it went over four volumes. And it was tough getting through. There was a magic system to learn. And I put the most into that.
From my point of view, for Steve's books, obviously Sorcery, because it was an epic and, you know, well-respected, you know, incredibly, you know, satisfying mega adventure. For my books, Death Trap, yes, it was a great cover, but it was kind of... It did exactly what it said on the tin. You know, it was a dungeon crawl, but there was had a dilemma that you had to, and a lot of people were upset, but kind of a bit disappointed, because there was a known player character called Throm, the barbarian, who you meet in the dungeon. And at the end, you're faced with this problem of being told that only one person get through alive. So it ended up with this kind of you or Throm. So that was some of that big impact on some readers at the time. And the other one for me was City of Thieves. People like Port Blacksand and all the horrible people who lived therein.
I have that one here. I'm just holding it up to the camera people. I'm familiar with the Sorcery series from Inkle's lovely adaptations recently, of course.
Fantastic, wasn't it? They did such a brilliant job on that, and they deserve the success they got with it. I mean, the apps version probably sold over 1 million units.
Yeah, it's
these are not ones that are given away. These are actual sale, and deserves it really. I mean, considering it was a text, a pencil and paper game, basically. It just hits a beautiful artwork, and a lot of input from Inkle as well into the book.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful the way they adapted that. And Death Trap Dungeon, of course, had a game adaptation recently with the wonderful Eddie Marsan as the narrator. I don't know if you've seen Mr. Norrell and Jonathan Strange, the BBC drama, as adapted from a book, but he's in that. It's wonderful.
Yeah, he's fantastic the way he recounts the adventure and the choices. He has that very kind of wonderful way of delivery, and I was delighted when they want to do a kind of interactive Jack and Ori adaptation of Death Trap.
Do you have any favorite, it's an odd question, do you have any favorite deaths in the series, any memorable deaths where you just thought that's ridiculous, or like that's unfair, like, oh Steve, you're being so unfair, or oh Ian, you can't kill people like that?
Well, of course we can.
I think that the Maze of Zagor is the one that I always get remarked on, because it's that was quite difficult. You go into it thinking it's just a maze, but there are transportation areas, so you lose track of mapping it.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, not the worst death, but people always refer to the cover of the original Forest of Doom, the shape changes, as innocent looking goblin sitting on a log that metamorphoses into this sort of hideous spiked creature that kind of devours you. And also the blood beast in Death Trap Dungeon is quite a famous way to end your days.
So as time passes and the kind of 80s roll on, and you're turning out quite a lot for these books, you know, an entire quadrilogy, I'm not really sure how they're called, and Ian, you're writing two or three books a year, I think it looks like. Do you ever get, and it's quite strenuous as well, do you ever get fed up of it? I mean, how are you keeping this fresh for yourselves?
Well, for me, I always say never again. And as soon as handed the book in, you kind of miss it. I'm always spending time thinking of new encounters, new monsters. Or if you visit somewhere, sometimes take a photo of something and say, oh, that would look great inside a Final Fantasy game. But, oh, you could turn that into a puzzle. Oh, you could do it. So it's never ending. I mean, it's 40 years of thinking about encounters and puzzles and problems and horrendous ways of terminating people's adventures. So it's an ongoing thing. It's, for me, it's never going to end. There's definitely going to be another one if the public still want it.
One of the beauty thing is that these days, in the early days, for example, Citadel of Chaos, I had a month to write that and managed to do it in a month. And I could never do that now. You could never do it as quickly as that. It was just folly. Well, you had to be at a certain stage of the development of Fighting Fantasy. It was becoming a sensation. And you couldn't really stop, really. Every way you turned, somebody wanted a new Fighting Fantasy book. And we were happy to oblige. But these days, we can spend a number of years, a few years on working up designs without having to worry about deadlines.
Did the way you approached the books change over the years? Did your style of writing them evolve? For instance, you know, I look at like Warlock of Firetop Mountain, then I look at Creature of Havoc. I love this old cover here. And Creature of Havoc seems more writerly, the passages of writing are more expanded, seems a bit more in depth. Was that you evolving the way the books were written? Could you feel kind of innovations in that genre as you were writing them? Was any of that going on?
Creature of Havoc was probably the most difficult one that I ever wrote. And you had to do things like learn a language. You know, that was a difficult thing. And funnily enough, going back to Creature of Havoc all these years later, I can't remember how you do it. I can't remember how you learn the language and use it.
Us, I think the style has matured and enriching the experience over time. Warlock Firetop Mountain obviously was a landmark. It was an innovation in interactive books, branching narrative with a game system attached, but it was effectively like a random dungeon. There was no sort of coherent overarching logic to the dungeon inside the mountain. So now my style is to try and create a logical and cohesive story with a lot of interaction with non-player characters and a lot more dialogue, and as well as the descriptive narrative. So I think we've probably made the whole process a lot more sophisticated over time to kind of get greater immersion through reading it, and also trying to, you know, increase the moments of the big moments as well.
Yeah. Have there been any books like yours, or pieces of interactive fiction, they may even be games, that have inspired you as you've been going along, things that have come out, you know, since on the way, on the journey?
I've never ever read anybody else's game books. Wow. I've been obviously aware of them because A, I don't want to be accused of plagiarism, and B, you know, it's, you know, well done them, but I just want to stay in the world of fighting fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, there was Choose Your Own Adventures out around about the same time originally, but they didn't have a game system. That was just effectively choose your own chapter. There wasn't a huge amount of decision points. Hugely successful, but we were different by adding the game system to it and giving a lot more choice during the adventure. So it's giving a lot more agency to the reader. I think that's why people like Fighting Fantasy so much, because they, it's all about their own choice, that empowerment through choice. And we, when we meet readers, they always talk about the experience that they were having as individuals. I was walking down the corridor. I fell down a pit and got covered in, you know, poisonous spiders. It was very much a sense of them being there. And that's what we wanted to try and achieve.
So these new books that you have coming out, The Shadow of the Giants and The Secrets of Salamonis, where do they sit within the kind of collected fighting fantasy works? Are they similar to a particular type of book? Are they as difficult as another type of book? Where do they position themselves?
Interesting question.
Well, I'll start, Steve, if you want to think about it. Mine is, it's in Alancia, where I've put most of, my fantasy titles, as opposed to the non-fantasy, fighting fantasy books like Blood of the Zombies and Freeway Fighter, but all my fantasy titles are in Alancia. So it's a new town. You start off in Firetop Mountain. You think you're on another quest inside Firetop Mountain, but no, innocently release these iron giants on the world who grow to this enormous height and set about destroying the whole place. And so you have to find out how to stop them from doing that. So you have to go to a new town called Hamelin, nothing to do with the Pied Piper, and meet a few interesting characters and discover the secret to their downfall. And it's similar in the sense that you need to discover stuff to defeat a boss, a big boss, but I've tried to make your experience in Hamelin a really enjoyable time. So it's not so much about the difficulty, it's about enjoying the environment you're in and meeting interesting people and being able to work with our artist I really admire, Mike McCarthy, who worked on the Fable games, has done the illustrations for the cover and the internal illustrations, and he's really beautiful what he's done.
Secrets of Salamonis was an attempt to get back into Alancia. Alancia is like the predominant geographical area for the whole of fighting fantasy, and it's split into three parts. One, Alancia, is reserved for Ian and myself. The old world is for sorcery, the sorcery world. And then a world for the present series writers, because we had to. And I'm a bit behind on the Alancian adventure, so this is one to restore the balance. But
as the 80s go on, as I say, and the fighting fantasy series kind of, well, I guess you guys slow down a little bit. You're not writing as many books as often. You're giving yourselves a bit of a break. And then you come to, I think it's 1991, and you decide to sell Games Workshop and move on and do different things. Why was it that you wanted to sell Games Workshop and move on?
Well, we've been running Games Workshop since 1975. We were hugely proud of what we'd achieved thus far, but we were also had become, you know, international best-selling authors, and we had zero time for ourselves. And that, as I said earlier, was creating quite a toll on our, not just our lives, but also on the, you know, relationships we had at the time. I mean, my girlfriend wasn't particularly impressed at the time, and had no time for social activities. And we had a guy called Brian Ansell who had been running Citadel Miniatures, which was part of Games Workshop. And he had ambitions to have a greater say in the Games Workshop. And we'd appointed him as managing director in 1986 to give us some breathing space to carry on writing Final Fantasy. And ultimately, he decided to make an offer to buy us out, effectively through a management buyout, which we agreed to in 1991. At the same time, we'd also seen the growth of video games. We'd stocked Commodore 64 games and Spectrum games in our shops. We'd had a bit of a tough time dealing with the early cartridges became massive overstocks in our shops as well. You remember the E.T. game being buried in the desert of the States, the overstocks. But nevertheless, we were intrigued by the growth of the video games industry. And I always had a kind of a secret, well, even an open ambition to be part of that one day. And obviously, sitting out of Games Workshop gave me the chance because in 1984, I'd written the lead launch product for Domark, a startup. That game was called Eureka, which came out in 1984 or 85, I can't remember now. And when I sold out a workshop, I joined Domark on their board as vice chairman and ultimately realized that invested at the absolute worst time because the 16-bit market was just about to fall off the edge of a cliff. So we decided to put four companies together, Domark, Simis, Big Red, and a company called Eidos Technologies to create NewCo Eidos, which we floated on London Stock Exchange in 95. I became executive chairman of Eidos. And so that was a whole new adventure. Obviously, the big point about Eidos was acquiring the rights of Tomb Raider and publishing in October 96 the first Adventures of Lara Croft.
And we can see Lara Croft behind you right now. Frozen in position, shooting something on the floor. There's a statue of behind Ian. And Steve, you would go on to help found Lionhead.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, I was been given a page in the Daily Telegraph on the weekend supplement, and basically it was to do with games and puzzles, anything I wanted to do. It was a great job. I mean, as a journalist, well, you know yourself, you get lots of freebies, and that was quite good. At Christmas, I remember in my office, you get maybe 20 games arrive in a week hopefully to be reviewed in the Daily Telegraph. But I had one spot to fill, so it's difficult. And anyway, so I knew Peter Molyneux from the interviews. He gave interviews, and we got talking about German board games, and discovered we both had this mutual love of German or European board games. Peter sold Bullfrog. We don't know how much, but he sold the company, and he wanted to put the money into a new company, which was to be Lionhead Studios and the four directors. I was particularly pleased with this because it was getting back into creating games rather than writing about them. It was a good move. And about 4 years later, Black and White finally came out. That was the main project at the time. So it would have taken 2 years, took nearly 4 years.
I remember it well. And the rest, of course, would be history as Fable came out, and eventually Microsoft came along. And so it's at this point, presumably, Ian and Steve, you remained close friends at the time.
Nothing's going to ever gonna destroy our friendship. Yeah. We've been friends now since 1966, so that's quite a landmark period of time. So we've obviously had our differences of opinions, but they've never become a problem that we couldn't resolve very, very quickly. We always put the friendship ahead of any possible disagreements.
And I've heard that you have quite a close relationship with Peter Molyneux as well, in that you all have a board game night. I've heard that you play every Tuesday night, and you have done for years now. Is that
since the 1980s? Yeah, I've been running the Games Night Club, and the thing about the Games Night Club is that we have a newsletter, and here we are on issue 595 of the Games Night newsletter. Yes, we have. So I've been secretary of the Games Night Club and write a newsletter and tend to slag everybody else off. We have a points system as well. So every game is recorded. If you win, you get X points. At the end of the year, we have this cup, the Pagoda Cup, which is given out to the winner. And of course, it's always a big prestigious event, but really it's just a spoof gentleman's club. We're just having fun. But during the pandemic, we didn't stop playing. We played games at boardgamearena.com and had a Zoom window open to do all the deals and generally slagging each other off.
And you have, from the looks of things, behind Ian, there is a shelf stacked so full of board games that there is no discernible wall space in view. It's chock-a-block. In fact, I don't know how you get the games out of there unless you have sticky fingers and you kind of sucker them out like an octopus or something. But apparently you have something like 1500 board games.
Yeah, probably a bit more than that now, but gives me great comfort to be surrounded by my board games. Same people like being surrounded by books, having board games around is great. And today, of course, board games are enjoying a huge renaissance, ironically because of the internet in many ways. That in the old days, if an independent person wants to publish a game, they probably make 5,000 copies, of which 4,950 end up in their garage because they were to reach the market because there weren't enough game shops around. But of course, today you can kickstart your projects. It's the market telling you whether or not your idea is a good one or not. You get funded up front and you can serve a global audience and pre-sell the whole print run, which is great. Not only that, you can learn how to play games on sites like Dice Tower. You can see games reviewed on BoardGameGeek.com. You can obviously buy games from whatever website you would care to shop from. So the internet has effectively enabled the rebirth and renaissance of board games, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a wonderful model. And of course, Dungeons & Dragons has resurfaced in an enormous way, and it's again through the internet with very popular people playing or groups playing it. It's become a whole.
Yeah, I mean, Critical Role. There's actors on the YouTube channel has got millions of followers, and of course, Stranger Things has also given a great boost to D&D. So, you know, Dungeons & Dragons, Fighting Fantasy, board games, all enjoying a but again, that's reflective of where society is now. People are enjoying vinyl records or enjoying physical books. I think you can't go totally digital as human beings. It has to be a mixture of analog and digital to really keep us happy, I think.
So let's wind things up because I know you're busy and I've kept you for a while. So there are a few questions that I tend to ask everyone. They're just some short questions. And the first of these questions is first game. So what was the first game you played? And it could be the first significant game or it could be the actual first game you played.
It was probably Monopoly.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there wasn't much choice in the 60s. So Monopoly, games like Buccaneer, Formula One, Cluedo. That's the fare I was brought up on, and chess. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to start Games Workshop, because we didn't particularly enjoy playing these games. We wanted to make games that we actually wanted to play. And the only games that were available that were enjoyable in the late 60s and early 70s were mainly American, from Avalon Hill in particular, and games like Diplomacy. Mm. I mean, Diplomacy was the first decent strategy game that I moved on to in the beginning of late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, and how about you, Steve? What was the first game you played? Do you remember?
Well, the first game I played?
Yeah.
Wow, that's going back a long way. Probably the Waddington's games, I should think. Right? So, but the one that I always have a special bond with is a game called The Warlord, and it was produced by a geography lecturer in what must have been 1968, something like that. And I was at University of Kiel at the time, and I was expounding the joys of diplomacy and getting lots of people. I was an evangelist. And I came across one friend said, "You've got to play this game. It's fantastic." And he said, "Oh, that's not bad diplomacy, but you want to play the Warlord. That's the real game." And there was one copy of the Warlord that, because Mike Hayes's nephew took it to Kiel University, and so there was this one copy that went round, and it was fantastic game. We went on to produce it at Games Workshop. It became Apocalypse. But it, for me, it's the Red Box Warlord that will always have that special memory. And it was one of the things that was special about it was the combat system, which was so simple and yet so brilliant. Brilliant.
Fantastic.
In a first video game, we used to play games on the PET computer, the Commodore PET, and also one of the early console systems called Intellivision. And Steve and I used to play this baseball game to crazy hours of the night when we shared a flat in the late 70s.
So what about the last game you played? What was the last game either of you played?
You had board games or video games?
Either or both.
Mine is Lost Cities. I play that probably 4 or 5 times a week.
Okay.
It's a little card game by a board game genius called Rainer Knizia. Rainer Knizia games have got a special formula for doing them. They're always interesting, simple to play, but you can apply strategies to it. You can play intelligently. And this is just the best card game I think I've ever played.
Yeah, I also like Lost Cities, but I haven't played it recently. I've been playing games like Century Spice Road and Stone Age.
Okay.
And obviously still play lots of games on my iPhone, and they've been also testing a game called Kinseed on Steam by some ex-Fable developers, and really about enjoying that.
Fantastic. And this is the clincher. What about best game? Which I guess is your favorite game? And again, either board game or video game, depending on what, you know, comes to mind, either or both. What's your best game?
Best game? Well, video games, I think I've always had a soft spot for real-time strategy games. Board games, I guess I'd say Dungeons and Dragons, because of the history. When this game came out, it was revolutionary, and it changed our lives.
I never fall for that best game malarkey. It's a bit like asking me which is my favourite child when I've got 4, you know. You love them all equally, so I think you have to give you a range here. Obviously, in keeping with Steve's choice of D&D, you know, it had such an impact on our lives. We cannot ignore that as being best in the terms of you know, what we enjoyed at the time and the doors that opened for us thereafter, and eventually from Warhammer to video games, etc. Video games, I mean, again, on an emotional front, Tomb Raider, because I'm very much involved with the launch of that in the 90s, but yeah, I haven't played it for some time. Board games, and Steve and I think have the same sort of love of mid-core strategy games, the ones I cited earlier, Century Spice Road and Stone Age and Splendor and Ticket to Ride, and those where they don't last all night. It's not like hard work. They're enjoyable. Lots of interaction, deals to be done, backs to be stabbed.
Mainly mine.
You know, I still like playing classic games. I still play Virtua Tennis on Dreamcast. That's great. I like playing Civilization. I mean, it depends who you're with, how many players, what you're feeling like, a heavy or a simple game. I think it's very difficult to have the best.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm going to wrap it up there because I know I've kept you for a while. Thank you so much, both of you. Steve, thank you for persevering.
Yeah, we made it eventually.
Through some technical issues.
Thank you for that.
And thank you for fighting fantasy and Games Workshop and Dungeons and Dragons and all the many things you've been involved with. But I guess for this podcast particularly, thank you for fighting fantasy. Everyone, look out for those two new books, Shadow of the Giants and Secrets of Salamonis. I think it was they're coming first.
Yeah, that's it. And they'll be we're inviting people to come along to Fighting Fantasy Fest Day as well, which is on Saturday, the 3rd of September, in West London, University of West London. I hope to see you there.
Yeah. So, listeners and watchers, look out for that and look out for these news books. But that's everything for us now. Ian and Steve, thank you once again for being with us.
Thanks very much. I'm delighted. May your stamina never fail.
I'm Bertie. That was One for One, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.